Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Banks are paying back their TARP money, so we're done with all those bailouts, right? Au contraire, today the Treasury Department handed out another multi-billion dollar rescue package. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making real chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More at MarsHealthyLiving.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, today the 30th of December, and it is good to have you here. A lot of people forget that the big Wall Street banks weren't the only ones that got bailout money. There was AIG, the insurance company. Various government lending and guarantee programs got $155 billion. Also, Detroit, GM and Chrysler got north of $50 billion, all told. And this afternoon, the Treasury Department decided to give the auto financing company GMAC another $3.8 billion on top of the $12 billion it's already gotten. Thing is, the reason GMAC is in so much trouble doesn't really have much to do with weak car sales at all. From New York Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Sure, GMAC's most important mission is to lend money to auto dealers and car buyers, but the firm's been dipping its tentacles into the housing market for years through its real estate arm, ResCap. And ResCap got heavily involved in the good old subprime market. Kirk Ludtke is a GMAC analyst at CRT Capital Group.
It's hard to imagine now, but at one point, ResCap was considered the stronger of the two businesses. You know, investors were more worried about the auto finance side of the business than the mortgage side. Obviously, that turned out to be the opposite.
ResCap lost almost $750 million last quarter. Meanwhile, the auto lending side, which now handles GM and Chrysler loans, made almost $400 million. Still, Ludtke says GMAC isn't strong enough to stand on its own, and letting it fail would be devastating for GM and Chrysler.
Some of the dealers wouldn't be able to find financing elsewhere, and others it would be disrupted, so they'd have to, you know, it'd probably take them some time.
But surely GMAC didn't have more exposure to the subprime market than some of the big banks, and they're paying back their bailout money, not asking for more. Well, Morningstar analyst Dave Whiston says GMAC just doesn't have the same cash-raising ability.
GMAC's problem, in a nutshell, is that they can't access private capital the way a Bank of America or a Chase or Wells Fargo and all those other banks can.
That's because GMAC can't sell stock. It's not a public company. Plus, its only consumer deposits come from an online bank called Ally that started up less than a year ago. In fact, starting a bank was the only way GMAC qualified for TARP money in the first place. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Estate planning is about to get a lot more complicated for some of this country's wealthiest families. The federal tax on large estates is set to expire at midnight tomorrow night. A not-too-close reading of the tax code thus presents this dilemma. If a rich person dies tomorrow, almost half of their wealth will go to the Internal Revenue Service. But if they can hang on till Friday, the heirs will be a lot richer. Maybe. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott reports now on the not-quite-death of the death tax.
Harold Apolinsky knows how he'll be spending New Year's Eve.
I will be the one really shouting when the ball with the Waterford crystals hits the bottom.
Apolinsky is an estate planner in Birmingham, Alabama, and he's one of the original crusaders against the estate tax. His wish for repeal is about to come true, temporarily. The 45% tax on estates bigger than $3.5 million expires tomorrow. Then a year later, it will return at a higher rate.
No one expected this to happen, and it's really shocking.
Robertson Williams has been following the long estate tax debate as a fellow at the Tax Policy Center in Washington. In 2001, Republicans passed a law phasing out what they called the death tax, but they failed to make the repeal permanent. With Democrats now in control, most expected Congress to extend the tax into next year. But Williams says lawmakers had other things on their minds.
I think that the Senate was so tired after battling over the health bill that they just couldn't get their heads together to do something, even temporarily, about the estate tax.
Estate planners say the lapse is raising some tricky questions for wealthy families. Jonathan Raccoon heads the trusts and estates practice at the law firm Debevoise in Plimpton. He says families may have been wondering how long to keep a loved one on life support.
I think that would be a mistake. It's my view that the best interests of the patient don't necessarily include minimizing taxes.
For one thing, Raccoon says Congress will likely reinstate the tax in the new year and make it retroactive to January 1st. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Steel pipes from China are today's Exhibit A for the tenuous nature of global free trade deals. Acting on a request the U.S. steel industry made back in April, today the International Trade Commission decided that American producers have indeed been hurt by imports of subsidized Chinese pipes. That means the Commerce Department can raise tariffs on those pipes, making them more expensive to import. And that, given the tit-for-tat nature of these kinds of things, virtually guarantees another round of back-and-forth sniping. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has our story.
The International Trade Commission still needs to submit written opinions to the Commerce Department, so new import duties won't take effect for about 2 weeks. And it really only applies to Chinese pipes used mostly for oil production. But U.S. industry groups hail what they see as a necessary first step.
These Chinese steel mills were able to send product into the U.S. market at below what it cost to produce as a result of government subsidies.
That's Nancy Gravatt, spokesperson for the American Iron and Steel Institute, a trade association. She says imports of Chinese steel tripled in recent years, and China's steel mills continued at full capacity even as the U.S. entered a recession.
This flood of imports was tremendously damaging to our market.
New import duties should make it too expensive for the Chinese to dump steel pipe in the U.S. Michelle Applebaum is a managing partner with the equity research firm Steel Market Intelligence.
They have a problem because we're actually the last one to the protectionist party. The Europeans and the Canadians have already put tariffs on that type of steel. So where China is going to sell that steel, I don't know.
Applebaum says China is producing expensive steel that's tough to sell, but Chinese leaders face a backlash if they curb production.
They're very worried about jobs, and so they've had a very rough time shutting down some of these higher-cost mills.
Chinese steel may become even more expensive next year. A separate decision about whether Chinese firms dump steel in the U.S. is expected in March. That ruling could lead to additional tariffs. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, low volume, light gains, details, numbers coming up. I figure we've got about a week left until the news cycle gets back to where it was just before Christmas. That is buried deep in the details of the health care bill. Congress is back in session next Tuesday, at which point the end game really begins. Negotiations between the House and Senate over what the final bill is going to look like. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer is with us now from Washington to talk about where we have been on health care this year and where we might be going. Nancy, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Kai.
It is kind of amazing that we are where we are with this bill, given everything that has happened in the past, I don't know, 8, 10, 12 months on this thing, isn't it?
It certainly is, Kai. Remember those public protests at the town hall meetings back in August? Some members of Congress couldn't even be heard above the shouting. And just to refresh your memory, Kai, here is some tape of a town hall meeting that Congressman Steve Kagan held in August. He's a Democrat from Wisconsin. You can barely hear him above the din.
So that was him in there somewhere talking before getting shouted down. I guess listeners have to take our word for it. Let me ask you, though, Nancy, about some of the criticisms of this bill. Maybe the first one of which is it's going to be painful before we see any benefits. It's going to take a while for some of the good to kick in, isn't it?
It is, although there are some parts of it that kick in right away. Both the House and Senate bills would bar your insurance company, Kai, from putting annual or lifetime limits on coverage and new policies that limits on how much they would pay out during your lifetime or during a year. And insurers wouldn't be able to drop you except in cases of fraud, and that's supposed to take effect soon. They don't exactly say when.
This is, any way you look at it, an expensive proposition, although it is supposed to reduce the deficit, the Congressional Budget Office says. How is Congress going to pay for this? I mean, what are the differences between the House and the Senate versions on that?
Well, the House would impose a surtax on individuals making more than $500,000 a year or couples making more than $1 million a year. The Senate would impose a tax on what are called Cadillac health insurance plans, and those are the very comprehensive insurance plans with very high premiums. The Senate would also increase the Medicare payroll tax. Both bills would cut Medicare by about $500 billion. And the Senate bill sets up a commission that would oversee Medicare payments to try to keep costs down. Now, a Harvard healthcare economist named Amitabh Chandra told me that he thinks that is a great idea, but he's worried that even if the Medicare commission is included in the final bill, it won't have any teeth.
As long as it can be watered down or if it's advisory, this commission is going to accomplish nothing. It has to be binding. It has to be like the equivalent of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve.
Well, Ben Bernanke being Time Magazine's Man of the Year aside, how might that work with the Medicare Commission?
It's unclear at this point, Kai. There could be cost containment as far as doctors' fees and hospital fees, which would annoy their lobbyists on Capitol Hill. The AARP, which is the lobby for seniors, would not be too happy. And I talked to AARP lobbyist John Rother about this, and he says, hey, don't pick on Medicare.
And you can't really lower costs than Medicare without taking into account system-wide developments in the way healthcare is paid for and how much things cost.
That's the nub of it right there, that what we have is a health insurance reform bill in this package, not necessarily a health care reform bill, right?
Exactly, Kai. The criticism is that neither bill does anything about the actual cost of health care. They just shift the burden of who pays for it. Under that so-called public option, the government-run insurance plan was supposed to help lower costs by competing with private insurers, but it probably won't be in the final bill.
On that final bill, quickly, Nancy, before I let you go, the White House wants something by the State of the Union, right? End of January, plus or minus?
End of January, early February. At this point, Kai, it looks like they might be able to do that.
Nancy Marshall-Genzer on the health care debate in Washington for us. Thanks, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Here's a twist on that old philosophical question about the tree and the forest. If a tree does fall in a forest, is it a crime? I ask because timber theft is on the rise, as are attempts by state governments to stop it. In Alabama, some new proposed regulations to protect that state's $15 billion timber industry are causing a dust-up, as Tanya Ott reports from WBHM in Birmingham.
If your image of timber thieves includes bumbling bandits backing up a pickup truck to the edge of a forest, forget it. Alabama State Forester Linda Casey says these are highly skilled professionals who sneak their big cutting machines onto remote properties or prey on small landowners. They get permission to cut the trees, but don't pay up.
Most landowners, they may only harvest timber off their property one time. They may be holding that sale to pay for their kids' college education, to pay for medical bills.
There are hundreds of thousands of small timber plots in Alabama. This year, thieves took more than $500,000 worth of trees. The Alabama Forestry Commission wants to impose stiffer penalties for things like trespassing. Currently, if a logger accidentally cuts trees on someone else's land, he faces civil penalties, including fines. The new law would make trespass a misdemeanor, even if the logger doesn't cut any trees. Chris Isaacson is with the Alabama Forestry Association, a trade group that opposes the proposal.
Boundary lines are marked either by fences. It may be painted boundary lines. It could be marked just by flagging. Sometimes those boundary lines may not have been marked for a number of years prior to someone coming in there.
Thick brush may also obscure the markings, according to professionals like Tom Thompson. He's a forest resource manager with building materials company Louisiana Pacific. I met him on a timber tract just south of Birmingham.
We have parked on this landowner's property without their permission on this side, so here's an unintended consequence. Now I'm subject to a misdemeanor fine for parking on the neighbor's property without their permission.
Thompson watches as a machine called a skidder picks up logs, strips the limbs, then drops them in a stack to be loaded onto a truck. Logging is a multi-part process. The landowner and logger agree to a price. The logger may subcontract the cutting to one person, the hauling to another. Many deals are done on a handshake, and sometimes they go sour. The proposed rules would require a record book that documents every step of the process, from cutting to loading to transport and delivery. Critics worry if anyone along that chain makes even a minor mistake in the record book, even a spelling mistake, they could be held criminally liable.
We're not interested in a spelling error. That's the reason I've got spell check on my computer currently.
Alabama Forestry Commission's Craig Hill leads a staff of 8 investigators covering the entire state.
We do not have the time or the manpower to go out and physically go to everybody's job site and look at a record. We don't want to go look at their record.
But Hill says he wants the records available if there's a problem. Back in the forest, Tom Thompson says he's concerned about timber thefts, but the proposal would penalize many for the transgressions of a few.
We have a shared concern about protecting the public, protecting forest owners. But again, what's being proposed on the table goes way beyond the scope of that.
Loggers and landowners in other states are watching what happens here. The Alabama Forestry Commission will announce next month whether it's imposing the new rules. Observers say if it does, there'll be a battle in the statehouse and the courthouse. In Birmingham, I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace.
Coming up, the upside to Times Square's new look.
People are always busy around here, so people don't look even at the stores, sidewalks, whatever. Now they have a time to relax, sit down in the chairs, look around.
But first, let's do the numbers. As I said, low volume produced little movement in the markets today. The Dow Industrial is basically flat, up 3 points, finished at 10,548. The NASDAQ added 2 points, a tenth of 1%, closed at 2291. The S&P 500 also flat, 0.2 points was the gain, ended the day at 1126. Trading got a slight boost from a report that showed a better-than-expected recovery in Chicago-area manufacturing, but that news was offset by a stronger dollar. That hurts companies that do a lot of business overseas. Microsoft threw 1.3% out the, wait for it, window. General Electric unplugged 0.5%. American Express slid 0.2% today. Biometric companies and security device makers lined up nice returns today after the Netherlands said its airports are going to use full-body scanners for all U.S.-bound flights. Pharmathene recorded a 70% gain, 70%. RAE Systems flew up 56% today. ICX Technologies up 35%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Throughout the trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org. Why is a derivative like a Thanksgiving turkey? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify the worlds of finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. It's the final trading day of the decade, and the decade's been bubbly. We're in for a blue moon. That's when there is a second full moon in a calendar month. An unusual treat on the last day of the year. We aren't due for another on New Year's Eve until 2028. And he's played Batman and Iceman. Val Kilmer turns 50. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, the past 364 days have been, when you stop to think about it, quite a year. But if 2008 is going to be remembered as the year of Lehman Brothers and TARP and too big to fail, what do you suppose 2009 is going to leave to the history books? Commentator Robert Reich offers this suggestion.
2009 will be remembered as the year Wall Street came back and Main Street got shafted. It started with hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars bailing out Wall Street's big banks. And much of that money, according to the TARP Inspector General's recent report, will never be repaid. It ended with those banks enjoying record profits and about to dole out some $20 to $30 billion in bonuses, while Main Street's small businesses can't get loans, and a record number of Americans have lost or are in imminent danger of losing their jobs and homes and savings. At the start of the year, Wall Street's biggest banks were said to be too big to fail. By the end of this year, they were even bigger. And they knew for sure they wouldn't be allowed to fail if their bets turned bad, which meant the bets could be even riskier than before. It was the year when the political power of Wall Street money became clearer than ever, in the form of generous contributions to both parties and platoons of lobbyists blocking reform. Even though Wall Street's recklessness caused the mess in the first place, the year ended without any congressional agreement on how to prevent it from happening again. Not even a modest proposal to better protect small borrowers and small investors from fraud. The president called them fat cats, and Congress thundered at them, but Washington did not plan to tax their upcoming bonuses, which they would not have earned without the bailout. Nor did Washington even attempt to claw back billions of taxpayer dollars quietly passed through AIG to counterparties like Goldman Sachs. Nothing was said in official Washington about resurrecting the Glass-Steagall Act that once separated investment from commercial banking. No mention was made of applying the antitrust laws to break up the giant banks. Nothing came of allowing struggling homeowners to use bankruptcy to renegotiate their mortgages. 2009 was the year when Washington called the bankers fat cats, but let them grow even fatter, while the rest of America got the scraps.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Send us your thoughts about 2009 or anything else you like. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Here with my annual and, yes, admittedly, very picky complaint about living on the West Coast. The television schedules out here really just stink. Football games on Sundays, they start at 10 o'clock in the morning. That's just not right. And on New Year's Eve, the ball in Times Square drops at what is for us 9 o'clock in the evening. Leaves us in limbo, if you will, for three solid hours. But when midnight East Coast time does finally chime in Times Square this year, the ball is going to be looking over a somewhat reconfigured streetscape. Earlier this year, New York City turned a chunk of Broadway into a pedestrian mall. So we asked WNYC's Andrea Bernstein to find out whether the increase in foot traffic has helped or hurt local businesses.
This isn't actually a square. It's a crossroads where Broadway cuts diagonally through a Manhattan street grid at 42nd Street. That's always created congestion. But when New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced his pilot project to turn over a chunk of the Great White Way to pedestrians last spring, it was seen as another of his crazy schemes. Meshuggah, right up there with banning smoking in bars and trans fats from restaurants. Mary O'Hara, a nurse from Brooklyn, didn't much care for it.
The street is meant for cars, not for people. And the city's busy. There's a lot of traffic. I know Mayor Bloomberg wants to see us all riding bicycles, but, you know, that's not reality.
The city transportation commissioner says traffic has actually improved in the area. But Caroline Hirsch, owner of Caroline's on Broadway, the stand-up comedy club, says there's been a fall-off in customers, and not just from the poor economy.
I had a very, very strong first 6 months of the year, which is the hardest time to have a strong 6 months. Okay, so it's not that. It was almost like clockwork when that happened. I think it's driven away a lot of the weekend traffic that comes here.
But turns out a lot of retailers find themselves liking the pedestrian plaza. Even though it's always looked pretty tacky, just a big red painted street with temporary tables and chairs.
It's good for us.
Hassan George works at 47th Street Camera and Computers.
Does that surprise you?
Yes.
Why?
Because people are always busy around here. So people don't look even at the stores, sidewalks, whatever. Now they have a time to relax, sit down in the chairs, look around.
Just a few stores down, Kawabena Blackshear, a waiter at the TGIF restaurant, says he's seen an uptick in foot traffic and tips.
Well, you get more tourists around in the plaza, sitting down, hanging out. They get a view of the square. It's better than it just walking past and not being able to stand by and really absorb what Times Square has to offer.
Tim Tompkins is the president of the Times Square Alliance, a business group. He says before the closure, people would come for Broadway shows, but were deeply unhappy with the congestion.
If people are coming to your store kind of in spite of the environment around it, then that's a problem.
He says used to be locals and tourists alike were putting their heads down and just trying to get through.
In the long term is something that was not good for the office buildings because the people who worked here in this neighborhood hated it. 96% of them said that they had walked at one point or another in the bed of the street because it was so crowded just getting around Times Square.
Tompkins is doing a comprehensive survey of the effect of the street closure, but he says it's trending positive. He's seeing more visits to his information booth and more ATM withdrawals in the heart of Times Square. That's consistent with what some urban planners, like Danish architect Camilla Van Doorn, say they've seen around the globe. She says studies show creating pedestrian areas increases revenues for retailers.
What happened earlier was, you know, people maybe have come in taxi, gone to a Broadway show, but then they jump right into the cab and disappear again. And you don't have that spin-off for the whole neighborhood of these giant volumes of people coming through there.
Not everyone sees it that way, but Tim Tompkins says driving is no longer driving the discussion.
The debate became about, you know, these chairs and whether people liked or didn't like the chairs, which to me really was this debate about what are our expectations for this public space.
Mayor Bloomberg decides whether to make the plazas permanent early next year. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note before we go this afternoon, something perhaps to consider the next time you ask for a couple of days off. If you've ever been to New York City, and possibly even if you haven't, you have probably seen or at least heard of those horse-drawn carriages, the ones that take tourists for quick rides through Central Park. Somehow, I always thought the horses looked a little bedraggled, but maybe it's because they're not getting enough vacation. The city's health department is proposing new rules for its hardworking steeds, a smoke-free environment, but also 5 weeks vacation for the horses. That's five, as in weeks. And that is Marketplace on a Wednesday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow ticked up 3 points. We'll call that basically flat. The NASDAQ up 2 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500 essentially flat. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gwartz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, the first word in business and economic news. And next time on this broadcast, let the bowl games begin.
We believe the total impact on the greater L.A. area is going to be between $350 and $400 million for the both games. That's as good as it gets for us.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.